1, 2, 3.
Welcome to In the Studio, a 21st century perspective on history's greatest rock albums. I'm Redbeard, and today in the studio, it's Justin Hayward and John Lodge of the Moody Blues on the anniversary of the dawning of progressive rock with Days of Future Past.
Nights in white satin,
the record company still had this that you had to have a hit single and only singles, and I remember them turning up and wanting us to do Over the Rainbow, and they kept saying it's going to be a big hit record for you, and it just, we were looking at them saying, you really don't know where we're at, do you? You have no idea at all. And I think that's the last meeting we ever took with A&R with a record company.
Yes, I love you. Yes, I love you. Oh, I love you.
We really believed in Nights in White Satin. We thought it was the greatest thing in the world, you know. But the trouble was, everyone was saying to us, well, you're joking, you know, it's in stereo and it's 4.5 minutes long, it's got this boring flute bit in the middle, you know, you can't dance to it. They forgot that, of course, you could make love to it. Hi, I'm Justin Hayward of the Moody Blues, in the studio for Days of Future Past.
Cold-hearted orb that rules the night removes the colours from our sight. Red is grey and yellow white, but we decide which is right and which is an illusion. Pinprick holes in a colourless sky let insipid figures of light pass by. The mighty light of 10,000 suns challenges infinity and is soon gone. Nighttime to some, a brief interlude. To others, the fear of solitude. Brave Helios, wake up your steeds. Bring the warmth the countryside needs.
The Moody Blues classic collaboration with the London Festival Orchestra called Days of Future Past was the forerunner of all the classically influenced progressive rock that would dominate the British music scene in the early 70s. Released within months of the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's album, it signaled the beginning of a time when rock music was starting to take itself much more seriously. In retrospect, some of the music may sound a bit dated now, some of the lyrics a little pretentious, but at the time, Days of Future Past represented the cutting edge of musical experimentation. The music and lyrics of the Moody Blues were analyzed and critiqued by symphony conductors. The band was invited to lecture at the Eastman School of Music, and one musical analyst said their lyrics were, and I quote, "the epitome of the romantic, metaphysical tradition of Wordsworth and Blake." Pretty serious stuff. This amazing half-century of timeless flight by the Moody Blues was hatched when singer-songwriter-guitarist Justin Hayward was just a boy growing up on Dean Street, Swindon in Wiltshire in southwest England.
Well, what happened was I was playing in groups when I was a kid. I had a guitar when I was had a ukulele, four-string ukulele when I was 9, and then a guitar which my mum and dad sent away for me from like a mail order company, you know, one of those ads in the paper. And I had that when I was 10. So then I started playing in local groups around my hometown in Swindon. And by the time I was 13, I had a Gibson, and I was actually earning enough just playing at, you know, local dances and socials and things and weekends to get a Gibson 335, which was the guitar I really wanted. I really wanted a, you know, guitar like Chuck Berry's or Joe Brown in England was the everybody's favourite guitar player. And Buddy Holly was my one big influence when I was a kid, and a lot of the groups that I was in, we used to do all his numbers. And then when I left school, it was obvious that I was going to be a musician, so my parents just said, well, get your 5-0 levels, which is the qualifications you get when you're 15 years old to leave school. And they're called O-levels in Great Britain. So I got my 5-0 levels, and they said, okay, you can do whatever you want to do. So I never went. I left school when I was 16, and I didn't have a proper job or anything. First thing I did was answer an advertisement in the Melody Maker, which is a music business paper in London, for a guitar player with a name group, it said. And I went up to this house in Eastbrook Road in Blackheath in East London, and knocked on the door, and the door was answered by a guy called Marty Wilde, who some people may know here, I don't know. But he was a rock and roll singer in the early 60s and had a group called the Wildcats. In fact, his daughter Kim Wilde has had a lot of success now. And Kim was just a little baby, you know, when I was with him. And then I got the job with Marty when I was 16, and I was with Marty for 2.5 years. So it was like straight in the deep end. And I just got lucky, really, I suppose. And then I started writing songs, and I made a couple of records on my own. And then I wrote to Eric Burdon because I knew somebody in Eric Burdon's office. And I wrote to Eric about just because I was just a guitar player. I wasn't really a singer, you know. I was a writer and a guitar player and then a writer. Pretty crummy guitar player as well. I was like a rhythm guitar player, not really a lead guitar player. And then completely out of the blue one day, I had a call from Mike Pinder and about the Moody's and ask him if he'd spoken to this person that was in Eric's office and had heard these couple of records that I'd done, and would I come up and see the rest of the boys in the band, you know? And so I did. I came up to a house in southwest London, in Esher, and I met with Mike Pinder, and I met Ray, and then Graham. I had an amplifier, and so I was in. You know, put me a step ahead of the competition.
Away. Something hard to find out why. Those gentle voices I hear explain it all in a
afternoon was the single, first single that they took off here. I remember it because I remember that playing the, they sent us a copy of the record and it had what we call an American fade. So it went Tuesday, it was gone, you know. 2 minutes, 30 seconds, that was it, mate, you're off.
The Moody Blues were formed in Birmingham, England in 1964 by keyboard player Mike Pinder, flautist Ray Thomas, and drummer Graham Edge. They'd had one hit, the 1965 single Go Now, featuring vocalist Denny Lane. But after Lane and bass player Clint Warwick quit in 1966, the Moodies were struggling. They needed new blood and a new direction. In 1967, they found both, with the addition of Justin Hayward and John Lodge.
I remember sitting around saying, you know, we're going to change everything, you know, and we can't be the Moody Blues of Go Now. And I know we discussed it, but I think we also had to, financially, we had to sort of look after ourselves a bit here, you know. And there was a promoter in Belgium who came to England and said, would we do some concerts in... they weren't really concerts, they were really club dates in Belgium. And he said it'd be worth this amount of money. And like... true troopers, we went, you know. But of course, we had to have the name Moody Blues. And but it was at that time, you know, it was a period of time when everyone was wearing the same clothes and looking alike. You know, this is what you had to be in those days. And we suddenly realized we were actually going to go nowhere, absolutely nowhere doing that. And as soon as we got rid of all these clothes and put our jeans on and T-shirts and decided to just play our own music, that's when it changed. And the name was good, you know, it's a nice name, so we just stayed with us.
Hayward remembers what the band was like when he joined.
It was still sort of a vocal harmony kind of group, and the group was actually built around Mike and his piano playing. So there was always that kind of keyboard influence, you know, and vocal harmonies. But the difference was, you see, that nobody, apart from Mike, was writing. And I was really a songwriter when I came to the band. But Mike's songs, nor my songs, really fitted in with the rhythm and blues. You know, we were trying to be terribly arty and do lots of sort of ethnic blues and stuff, which was great. But it didn't really get us anywhere. We did that for, we carried on with that for, I suppose, about another 8 or 9 months. But it really wasn't working, you know, and we were, our price just dropped. We you know, we had a hard time paying the rent and the payments on our instruments and everything, and we had to sell the van and all that kind of stuff. But so it got pretty grim. And then the big change came when we were coming back in the van one night from Newcastle after being a couple of weeks in Cabaret, which was dreadful. But we were playing what they call cabaret clubs. We were doing cabaret club circuit. You're doing maybe 2-3 gigs a night, different places you get booked. And you do like 2 45-minute spots. You start at 8 o'clock, you do the first place, and then, you know, you finish like 3 o'clock in the morning. They're supper sort of places where people dance and they eat as well. So, I mean, the waiter ordering scampi and chips has got to be louder than you playing. In the quiet bits, you'd have, steak and chips twice over here, you know, and while you're into a really emotional bit of you bearing your soul. But what finally happened, it got very depressing for us, and then we were at a place called Stockton near Darlington. We'd done the gig, and we were in the dressing room afterwards, this little sort of cupboard, and this guy came in, knocked on the door, and he said, can I come in? So we said, yeah, yeah. He said, and we thought, well, he just wants an autograph or something, you know. So he said, I've got to tell you, he said, you're the worst band I've ever seen in my life. He said, I take the wife out every Thursday. He says, we come out, he said, for supper. And he says, I thought you were bloody awful. He says, it's cost me £2. He said, come and see you. He said, you're bloody awful. He said, I thought he had to tell you that. So he just left. And we thought, bloody hell, he's right, you know. We were bad. We'd sunk to that sort of level. So coming back in the van that night, we said, listen, you know, this is a complete waste of time. Let's just do our own material. Let's write our own material and see what happens. Take it from there. So we decided to write a stage show that was like a sort of mini rock opera.
The studio on Facebook at Redbeard Rocks, on Twitter and online anytime at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard with Justin Hayward and John Lodge of the Moody Blues for the anniversary of Days of Future Past.
Hello, Justin Hayward of the Moody Blues here.
And I'm John Lodge in the studio for the Moody Blues
with Redbeard.
John Lodge joined Justin Hayward and me in the studio.
Now, were these songs, such as Tuesday Afternoon, Evening, Time to Get Away, and Nights in White Satin, were they written with orchestral arrangements in mind and intended?
No, the songs weren't written with an orchestra in mind, and they weren't recorded with an orchestra either. The orchestra plays in the gaps in between, and it was a natural way to put our songs that we'd already formed and the storyline that we'd already formed across. And the idea of the orchestra made the whole thing fall into place and made the whole concept much more interesting from a lot of people's point of view.
Was it really a marvelous accident?
Yeah, it was. Clutching at a wonderful... straw, yeah. We didn't know what it was.
I think it's when opportunity meets preparedness.
Yeah.
Really. It really was that. And we did have a stage show, but we did have, we used to do 2 45-minute sets. And the first set was copies of American songs, really. We used to just copy all the American Hit Parade. And the second set was our stage show. And when we were invited to go into the studio, I think we were only chosen because we really were the cheapest band the record company had got. And we didn't have a record contract as such. And we were only allowed to go in the studio from sort of 10 till 2 and 4 till 6 and 8 till 12. It was that type of sessions, you know, 3-hour, right. 4-hour sessions.
And we recorded nights. We did nights for Easy Beat. And then we were in the... in our van going to a gig the day it was on the Friday lunchtime, the day it came out. And it was the first time we'd ever heard it back, and we heard it on the radio, this Nights in White Satin, and we thought, God, that's great. And God, that's really good. You know, it never occurred to us before, because you don't when you're playing it. You know, it's not until it's like going into the control room listening to a playback. We hadn't actually done that with Nights. We'd just recorded this thing, never listened to it, and gone off in the van. And so we heard it on the radio, and then... by the time we'd got to the gig where we were going, we'd convinced ourselves that we couldn't possibly do it any better, you know, that was the most brilliant recording we'd ever made. So when we got to the gig, we phoned up the BBC and we said, you know that thing called Nights in White Satin that we did for Easy Beat? And I said, yeah. So they said, have you got the tape of it so that we could... No, they said, oh, no, we broadcast it and then we reused the tape. We never kept that. And we thought, oh, no. We'll never be able to capture that moment again. You know, it's an emotion gone. And, of course, it was completely out of crap, because we did. We went in the studio and recorded it, and it was better. But strangely enough, I went into the BBC, and I was doing some stuff for the World Service of the BBC. The British are great for propaganda, you know. Had this thing called the World Service, where they broadcast all over the world and pump the you know, really outdated, I'm all right, Jack, British point of view to the third world, and tell them about etiquette and about stupid word games, you know. And anyway, they, seriously, it's actually very good, the World Service. This guy was working for the World Service, and he said, you remember you did recorded Nights in White Satin for Easy Beat, you know, in 1967? And I said, yeah. He said, well, we made a copy of it for the World Service, because when it went out. And I said, you did? And he said, yeah. And he said, as I knew you were coming in, he said, I brought it out here, look. And he played it, and it was actually very good. It was very good indeed. But it was very bare, you know. The record had much better echo, and the record had a sort of spacious emptiness about it that this recording didn't have, you know. We were young guys who really had no right to be in the studio situation. We hadn't really done that much recording work, not of our own material anyway, and nothing very innovative or anything like that. We owed Decca, the record company, because we hadn't had any record success for a while, and we actually owed them £5,000, which is an advance that they'd given us to get us out of trouble. So we never had a recording contract to make albums. We just had a recording contract to make a certain number of singles. But they really wanted to recoup their £5,000 that we owed them. So they were making a series of demonstration records to demonstrate stereo, which they Decca really believed in. Decca were primarily a classical label, and London Records in America, a black rhythm and blues soul, and on one hand, which was their sort of rock and roll division, and then classical music. There was only a couple of other bands that they had at the time, I think 10 years after, and us, that were in a kind of different category. So anyway, they wanted to make this series of demonstration records on the Duramic sound system, full frequency range system, and they had this cymbal with a sort of ear with echoey things coming out, you know, to show you that it was this particular stereo system. Full frequency range, so nothing was cut off the top or off the bottom, it was classically cut.
The time of day doesn't matter.
Justin Hayward of the Moody Blues.
They put in what they call a budget price album, and in old English money, we changed our money system. In old money system, it was used to be 29 and 11, 29 shillings and 11 pence, and normal albums were twice that amount. 29 and 11 would be $2.50, so that was like half price, because it was to get people to buy stereo systems and to get them interested in stereo, because Decca were also made consumer products, and they made stereo systems as well.
See you. must re-energize by the sun's rays every day. Take a look out there, planets everywhere. Shadows on the ground never make a sound, fading away in the sunset. Night has now become day for everyone. I can see it all from this great height. I can feel the sun slipping out of sight, and the world still goes on through the night.
In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online anytime at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard with Justin Hayward and John Lodge of the Moody Blues for the anniversary of Days of Future Past.
Hello, Justin Hayward of the Moody Blues here.
And I'm John Lodge in the studio for the Moody Blues
with Redbeard. I remember exactly where I was and everything around Nights in White Satin. I remember I was in a small flat that I had in Bayswater in West London. It's like a one-bedroom flat. And I remember just sitting on the side of the bed. I knew I wanted to do something in 3/4 time or 6/8. And I just started playing around. I had this big old 12-string guitar that I'd actually borrowed from a guy called Lonnie Donegan. I had this big old 12-string, which was his, actually. Later, he wanted it back not long after that. But I did actually record the song with it. I just started playing around with it, you know, in E minor, and this song just came out. And it was like as long as it took to play, that's as long as it took to write. It was done like in 5 minutes, the whole thing. It was amazing. And I remember being very pleased with it, and I remember feeling particular. You know, it's really a song about women, and it sounds corny, but it's like sort of adoration of women, really. I've always been hung up on women, I suppose, you know, but it's that's the closest I can get to any sort of meaning behind it. We were rehearsing down at this place in Barnes, and I took it down to rehearsals the next day. And I remember Mike saying, well, it needs something, yeah, it's really good. It needs something else, though. And I hadn't written a sort of flute solo bit, so we all kind of did that together, you know, put that flute solo thing in it. And then it just took form. And the next thing I knew, it was part of our act. And then we really believed in Nights in White Satin. We thought it was the greatest thing in the world, you know. But the trouble was, everyone was saying to us, well, you're joking, you know, it's in stereo and it's 4.5 minutes long. It's got this boring flute bit in the middle. You know, you can't dance to it. They forgot that, of course, you could make love to it. So they really discouraged that until we were playing at Midem, which is a big music festival in the south of France. And the Supremes, for some reason, were supposed to go on live, onto live Eurovision television. And they didn't. They weren't there, or somebody got there late, or it was like something to do with the band, as I remember. The arranger or the band leader didn't make it or missed his flight or something. So they were rushing around looking for anybody else on the bill. It was about a dozen acts on the bill who could actually play live. And we were the only people there who could actually play live. Everybody else was there to mime to their songs. And so we just went on and filled this like half an hour spot. And it was just a sheer fluke. It was Eurovision all over Europe, shown all over Europe. And we played Nights in White Satin. And literally the next day, the record company went bonkers, you know, with, we've got to have this record. And within 2 weeks, it was number one in France. And it was number one there for 11 weeks. Then it really spread from France. It was out in Great Britain. It got into the top 20 in Great Britain. It just sort of spread, you know. It's a very pure song, you know, Nights in White Satin. It doesn't mess around. I think it was just a very emotional feeling. I remember a guy that we had as our manager in those days. He was a guy who actually owned a heating and ventilating firm from up in the northeast. He just cracked up, you know, in the studio while we were making this. I mean, he was just like in tears, you know. It was just a very emotional thing, because it was not only is it a very emotional song, it was a very beautiful thing to be part of one of those type of recordings. And it's, you see, everybody who makes a record, it's like Platters, Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, you know what I mean? They must have known when they made that record, when they went into the control room, or when they're standing there making it. They must have thought, you know, you get the shiver up the spine and you think, God, this is great and everything. You don't know whether anybody else is going to feel that, but you feel that. See, I've made records where I've felt that, but nobody else has ever agreed with me, you know, and it's not, I haven't been able to share it with a lot of other people. But Nights was one of those. It was the realisation of a lot of our own dreams and everything. I think it's just that songs like that, they mean such a lot to so many people. And that's a wonderful thing to be able to share, you know. And the whole point about the thing is to be able to, when people say, don't you get tired of singing nights on stage or anything, I mean, the whole point about it is to do exactly that, because it's what people want to, people want you to sing it, and they want to experience that particular moment of being in the auditorium when you do that song. And that's a great thing to be part of. It's a great gift for an audience to be able to give an artist, because they're waiting for that song. And like I said, it just means so much to so many people. I know what music means to me, and I know what particular songs mean to me. Moody's are very fortunate to have had several of those kind of songs that sum up moments in time and in people's lives, and it means something to people in terms of their own life and their own experience.
Nights in white satin, never reaching the end. Letters I've written, never meaning to send. Beauty I'd always missed, with these eyes before. Just what the truth is, I can't say anymore, 'cause I love you. Some try to tell me thoughts they cannot defend. Just what you want to be, you will be in the end, and I'll love you.
Yes, I love you.
composer and lead singer of Knights in White Satin, Justin Hayward of the Moody Blues.
I don't think it came out here for a couple of months. It came out in 1967, the summer of 67 in Great Britain. It came out a bit later in the fall, I think, here in United States. And then it was the second single in America, and I think it did reasonably well in America in 1967, 68. But it actually became number one 6 years later in America, 1973.
Watchlights fade from every room. Bedsitter people look back and lament another day's useless energies spent. Impassioned lovers wrestle as one. Lonely man cries for love and has none. New mother picks up and settles her son. Senior citizens wish they were young. Cold-hearted orb that rules the night removes the colors from our sight. Red is gray and yellow white, but we decide which is right and which is an illusion.
I'm Redbeard, back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guests, Justin Hayward and John Lodge. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions, copyright 2017, all rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brune. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net.